My name is Lizo Mguni, and I'm the spokesperson for Old Mutual Insure. We are excited to bring you this podcast, which forms part of the series that supports the very prestigious 2023 South African Car of the Year competition. Sponsored as well by Old Mutual Insure and presented by the South African Guild of Mobility Journalists. Talk with us on our socials with the hashtag SACOTI2023. Road safety is a huge concern in South Africa. Studies continue to highlight our country as one of the most dangerous countries to drive in, with high rates of road accidents, injuries, and fatalities. While it is every road user's responsibility, there is much that can be done to improve the situation. Initiatives such as the 2023 South African Car of the Year competition, sponsored by Old Mutual Insure, aim to promote innovation in the automotive industry and raise awareness about road safety. However, it is important for drivers to also take responsibility and practice better driving habits to ensure their own safety and that of others on the road. So today, we are going to take a deep dive into the issue of road safety. What consumers need to know, how it impacts insurance, the responsibility of each player, and the top tips for consumers on how to be safer on South African roads. Joining me today to help tackle this subject is Eugene Herbert, MD of the driver training organization MasterDrive, together with training director at the company, Derek Kirby. Welcome, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Eugene, let's dive right in and start with you. Firstly, what led you to starting MasterDrive and where does your passion for road safety come from?
Thank you for the question. I think I need to go back a little bit before MasterDrive started. The holding company, which is RAC, started in 1997. And it's just so coincidental that MasterDrive as an organization also started in 1999. But we acquired the company in 2008. And as a result of that, we have now morphed into multiple versions on the Master theme, which we have Master Trucker, Master Biker, etc. But the primary reason why we would be involved in road safety is because we see firsthand the results of bad driving. And we deal with individuals, namely the drivers, whose bad behavior contributes significantly toward the carnage on our roads. And we believe that by introducing the skills that we do, we can change the way people engage with other motorists and thus reduce the fatalities. And we help them contribute money toward the fiscus in a positive way.
Absolutely. And in your opinion, would you say a lot of the fatalities that we see are mainly due to just 100% the drivers, or do you think pedestrians and the way pedestrians use the roads and interact with roads also plays a part sometimes?
It's not one, it's a combination of those. And if I can just share some statistics with you, I think it's estimated that between 50 to 60% of fatalities on the roads are pedestrians. And we know why that happens, because they walk in on the side of the road, probably wearing dark colored clothing, and maybe if it's the weekend under the influence of alcohol. And as a result, they become targets inadvertently for motorists who are not paying attention. The international statistic that contributes toward crashes and fatalities is human behavior. And it really depends on what you're looking at. It's either between 85 or 95%. Now that can be measured, but there are other factors, the roads that we drive on. And I'm quite sure that you, in traveling through Gauteng, have noticed that there's these enormous caverns on the road. We commonly call them potholes. Now that contributes in no small way to some of the carnage, but still, if a driver were following the driver in front of him at the correct distance, they would probably be able to take evasive action. So it's all very well saying it's the infrastructure that's to blame, but if we adjust the way we do things, speed also is a contributing factor. So now you talk about drivers who follow the rules of the road. And if they are, they needn't be in that predicament. So it's a combination of things. And if I can just direct you toward one of the best known international best practice standards, it's the SAFE system. And that highlights, and it's adopted by most first world countries, that it sees a combination of infrastructure, individuals, pedestrians, and a host of other factors that all contribute toward the carnage on the roads.
Fascinating. Does that dovetail the work you do with the South African Road Safety Foundation, as well as the Road Safety Partnership? Tell us a little bit more about why you got involved with these initiatives and what they're about?
I'm glad you asked that question because, as I indicated earlier, what we see is a direct result of bad driving. Now, we don't make an unseemly amount of money out of what we do by training drivers, but we benefit in some way or other from what is happening on the road. Because there's bad drivers, we can train them, we can make better drivers. But there's still a host of other people out there who won't benefit from our skill, expertise, and the like. So we made a commitment that we would support initiatives by deserving organizations that would help create awareness on what's happening on our roads. And toward that end, there are three particular projects that we support. One is the Road Safety Partnership South Africa, which is affiliated to Global Road Safety Partnership, which is based in Geneva. That focuses on making sure that children get home safe and get to school safe. It's a really a magnificent program. The Road Safety Foundation talks to motivating change in the way we do things, hopefully pitched at government levels so that we can also involve other organizations, because that's where the money comes from in order to introduce change. And then the last one, which is the Road Ethics Project, it's a Dr. Lee Randall that started this, and the focus is on the taxi industry. But that's a subject for another discussion. And you will see that what our commitment is to put in time, resources, and some money into organizations that can carry this as a social initiative.
Interesting that you mention the effect of taxis and taxi drivers on South African roads and road safety. What sort of trends have you been seeing in that space? In particular, I know it's quite pertinent to the topic of insurance.
The issue of taxi drivers, I think, sometimes gets undeserved attention. And the reason why I share that with you is because taxi drivers, we know how they behave. They are doing that not because they necessarily want to, but they're under pressure from the owners, the operators, and in many instances, the occupants of the vehicle to get them to a particular point on time. Now, I don't know what the hit rates are in terms of insurance for taxi drivers, but think of the other people, other motorists that engage with them. They decide to become policemen in their own right, so therefore they will cut in front of the taxi. They will become obstacles in the road of the taxi that's really progressing. Now, on that, it's my personal opinion. I would rather have the taxi in front of me where I can see him than behind me. Now, as a result of that, think about what it's going to do to you as the driver. So, yes, you cut in front of the taxi and he bangs into your motor car. Who's going to lose? It's you. The taxi may not have insurance, so your insurer is not going to be too enthused with the manner in which you drive. So if we accept, and as a company, we have a mantra. It says, drive nice, it's contagious. Giving the other motorist the benefit of the doubt. And I can promise you, if you're ever in a difficult situation and you want to get into the queue where you've taken a wrong turn or something, the person that will let you in is the taxi driver. But you won't have the mother from Sandton driving a huge SUV giving you space in which to maneuver. So I believe that if we change our attitude toward those taxi drivers, we can all have a better driving experience. Not a perfect one, but a better driving experience on the road.
Absolutely. I think there have been a few moments when I have felt my own road rage getting out of control, but only in the car. I don't take it out on the car and do crazy things. So 100%, I think improving behavior and our own behavior and how contagious that might be towards other road users like taxi drivers is an important point that we should consider. Derek. You're both a volunteer paramedic as well as a training director at Master Drive. So you must believe in road safety and imparting life-saving skills and information onto others. Where do these two jobs intersect and align for you?
Look, these two intersect quite well. For example, when I'm on the scene for a collision, I would look at it from, obviously I'm there to save a life, but I look at it and think, you know, could this have been prevented? You know, a large majority of collisions are human error. So I look at it and go, well, there's a lot of trauma here. If someone was driving properly, et cetera, this could have possibly been prevented. In addition to that, we run a lot of bespoke programs like our truck rollover prevention program, high performance program, Skidpan. And, you know, at least we can assure our customers that at any given time, there's a medic on duty because I'm there running those programs or overseeing them.
I must just point out, Lisa, that we haven't had one.
That's excellent, Derek. As a training director, what does your job entail? Would you say you train people to avoid common road mistakes, or does training allow people to better respond to risky situations?
You know, let me just sort of, you know, clarify. My job as a training director is to develop, research, and put together training programs for Master Drive. And, you know, this is interesting because I have to look currently 3 to 5 years ahead. So I continuously meet with customers and say, look, what is your training need when it comes to your drivers or fleet in 3 to 5 years? And customize the program accordingly. What we currently now do is, you know, with the training programs, we need to look at three aspects of how to get through to different ages. Fortunately, we're in an era where people are very digital, and that our training programs have to talk to this. Otherwise, how are we going to get across to these people in the training environment? And, you know, the main concept of any training or driver training is to ensure people drive correctly despite the incorrect actions of other road users out there. You know, that's the primary thing. But like I said, my job is, what's the best possible way to get it across and the best medium to get it across to people?
Lisa, if I can just share what our philosophy is, and I think it was the founder of Apple said that if you wait for your customer to tell you what he needs, by the time you give it to him, it's too late. So our approach is to, and we have partners across the world that provide best practice. But remember, we operate in a rather unique situation. Africa is Africa. You show persons overseas, one of our taxis that's got a load on the roof, double the height of the taxi, they find it impossible to accept. So we've had to adapt. And as a result of that, we now go into the whole of Africa because we deliver, as Derek mentioned, the word bespoke programs that suit you, particularly company-wise, and satisfies what your needs are.
Absolutely. And Derek, you touched on the points around researching new training aspects and new training techniques. I'm quite interested in what training techniques have had to adapt for example, electric vehicles where the acceleration might be almost instantaneous. And most people who are used to combustion engine cars expect or have come to form habits around a slower response when it comes to acceleration. I know on the insurance side, that's changed the kind of risk that we're presented with when it comes to insuring electric vehicles as opposed to combustion engines, internal combustion engines. But from a training side, what sort of road safety differences have you seen in terms of the training material around road safety for those cars?
Look, and let me just talk to the EV aspect of it. We did spend a few years creating an electric vehicle program, and it's more relevant in our commercial vehicles now. We do work with a company that runs electric trucks, and you know, like you said, you can't just get from a normal ICE vehicle, internal combustion engine vehicle, into an EV. There's certain things you need to do. You need to, you know, come off the accelerator a little bit earlier because there's regen braking, etc. So we go into that. You know, you've got to plan, and that's key for us. Is we always try and train people to look 12 seconds ahead in traffic. Now, in an EV, you've definitely got to do that because you're monitoring the battery. So I can't just, you know, get there, hard brake, move out, accelerate. I might be stuck on the freeway side of the freeway with no battery power. So there's a very unique way that we train people to adapt from an ICE vehicle to an electric vehicle.
If I can share with you the reason why we got involved, because when we saw the advent of EVs, we knew because of the space in which we operate, which is corporate, fleet managers would need some type of direction because you've got to create and put in place policies that govern the way you're going to introduce these new vehicles. For example, where personal had a petrol card to go and refuel their vehicle, now they've got to go to a depot and plug in their vehicle. Now, are you going to give the man a plug-in station at his home, aside from the household version, or their routes that they plan in, will they be able to top up the batteries? On motorcycles, for example, you see what's happening over there. They pop in, they have a battery pack, they replace it, and they're on their road again. Now, one of the big areas that we found that people have concern about is anxiety with regard to the range. So a good vehicle today will get you 400 kilometers, but you drive it badly, you're going to do 200. So if we can train drivers to use that power or that energy that's at their disposal in an efficient manner, they will be more productive in the workplace. Now, that's really powerful because we can assist companies not only to improve safety standards, but because they're in EVs, they're contributing positively toward the environment and the reduction of CO2 emissions.
Absolutely. Absolutely agree with that, Eugene. What would you say are some of the most common mistakes people make on the roads? How do you train them to help deal with this? I know, Eugene, you already touched on some of the characteristics that pedestrians or mistakes that pedestrians might make. But in terms of actual people driving the cars, what are the common mistakes that you're seeing there?
Derek mentioned just now one of the things that we endeavor to get people to drive to, namely 12 seconds ahead. You look at the average motorist on the road. He's driving so that he can read the bumper print that you've got. Now, that's, if it's a humorist, that's great. But 9 times out of 10, it's an expletive to indicate that you shouldn't be that close. So if we look at motorways, the one between Johannesburg and Pretoria, for example, the last statistic I saw was about 85% of the crashes there. And remember, we talk about crashes or collisions as opposed to accidents, because this could be avoided. They are as a result of incorrect following distance. So they rear end collisions. And it may seem strange, but when we get persons to learn to drive 3 to 4 seconds behind the car in front of them, it's a bit of a challenge because, you know, you get this response. Yeah, but if I do that, somebody's going to slip in front of me and I'm going to land up back where I started. Stupid is the answer I give you, because it's more a psychological problem than a reality problem. And in fact, I did a test on the R21 between Tambo and Pretoria. I'm fairly busy, and I kept my 3 seconds following distance behind the vehicle in front of me. And yes, a vehicle pulled in, and I backed off. So now I'm giving another 3 seconds, as it were. Another vehicle came in. On average, 8 to 10 vehicles would come in and slip in. Now, that doesn't take into account the fact that I would pull out into the right lane and overtake. So if worst case scenario, 10 vehicles cut in front of me and I had to slow down, how much time am I talking about? Less than a minute. So it's a psychological fact, I think, that people feel somebody's intruding in their space. So if by way of our training, you can create that space that you respect other people's right, albeit that it's not ideal, to move in over there, psychologically, you're better prepared to deal with that. That's just but one of the things. And, you know, following too closely with modern motor cars, they talk about all vehicles, new vehicles having ADAS, Advanced Driving Assistance Systems, which is ABS, EBD, Adaptive Cruise Control, all of these things. That's contributed in no small way to people believing in their technology and as a result that they don't have to apply safe driving habits. But what we do need to remember, at some point, the laws of physics take over. And I don't care what technology you've got in the vehicle, you can have a crash. And so if by allowing people to experience this, and this is what we do in some of our training programs, you know, I think young people today, they have the sense of immortality. And that's the generations that Derek's talking about. So he drives a car that's got ABS and then rides right on the rear end, right, diplomatically. And you ask him, so why would you travel so close? No, I've got ABS. So we work toward dispelling some of the myths, and we do this by way of newsletters, communications, etc., appealing to people. The training, though, that we see, and I must give you a statistic, typically in a company, by the time we've engaged with them and gone through their fleet, we see a 50% reduction in crashes.
That's incredible. That's a huge reduction. Interesting. I just wanted to touch on, you mentioned the psychological aspects, as well as the, you know, I think so, as soon as it becomes psychological, it becomes very hard to change and people might become set in their ways. So it's interesting that you see that drop off of 50% in collisions. But how long do you see that drop off in? Or do you think that people should be going back to training every 2-3 years just to get a refresher?
Lisa, I want it to be known I didn't give you that question, but I'm so glad you answered it. Because, you know, some people believe once trained, always trained. I often use the analogy, how would you feel if you went to a doctor who never revisited his skills or her skills? You know, didn't keep up to date with what's going on. I don't think you'd feel very comfortable them treating you. And that's the same philosophy that we have. I think we did some research and it showed that memory retention on what you were doing after a year is eroded by something like 50%, after 2 years, 70%. So our philosophy is that we should have you at least once a year to revisit training aspects. Now, please remember, and I think you've seen it on the amount of signs that get introduced, new rules, sub-rules, etc. People who have gone for their license 20 years ago, and the technology in vehicles have changed. So give yourself the benefit of upskilling yourself on a regular basis. And I promise you this, that when corporates take this seriously in terms of health and safety policy, they not only see a reduction in crashes, which is a financial saving, but the psychological component that relates to the person who's on the road makes them feel more confident, competent, and as a result, even spills over into the home environment where the partner will know that they're going to come home safe. If you don't mind, I'd just like to raise the issue of road rage. You know, people say, well, do you run a road rage prevention training program? We did at a time, but you know what we found is that when you look at things that you can do that you shouldn't do that could possibly result in road rage, such as, you know, don't follow too closely in front of the car behind you, don't show evocative signs that would indicate people should take a certain direction, don't swear and shout, etc. What we found after dealing with a psychologist, it's relatively easy to say, don't do this or do the following. But what gave rise to that incident, it could have been that you had a fight with your wife, your kids, or vice versa, with parents. So the moment you exited at home, you weren't in the ideal mental frame. You then went to work because you were now late and your boss sat on you. So that was the last straw when you got into the car and some idiot who now sees this as a weapon, eh? They wouldn't do it normally, but they seek to engage with you. So it's a far deeper subject. But yes, there are certain things that you should or that you shouldn't do. And we strongly advocate never respond to another motorist. Don't think you're going to get even with them by trying to tailgate them when they've been doing that to you. It's just a recipe for disaster.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And we've seen on our side, as you mentioned, the younger generation who think of themselves as immortal, definitely higher claim frequencies when it comes to motor vehicle accidents there, which is typically what drives the more expensive premiums that get charged for younger males in particular across the insurance industry. But it's comforting to know that that can be corrected or at least slightly reduced by through training and regular training and regular reinforcements as well. And as you heard, road safety can result in benefits at home as well as in terms of your insurance premium that you pay every month.
I'm not sure what OMRI's policy is, if I can just talk about distracted while driving for a moment. We know that using a cell phone is illegal, huh? But people think that because it's hands-free, it's safer. If I can just use the opportunity to dispel that myth, because research, and I think as John Hopkins University in the US showed, it's not the fact that you've taken your eyes off the road, although that's not ideal. It's not the fact that you're using one hand to dial because you have less control of the vehicle. It's the fact that the body or the brain cannot process two equally important tasks simultaneously. So you talk about cognitive impairment. Now, the facts that they tell us or the statistics that they give us that 25% of crashes are as a result of that. Don't you think that's one of the easiest things to manage?
Absolutely.
And yet I don't know any insurance form that when the person has said, how often will they say that they were on their phone when they had a crash? Huh? Not likely. So, but there are methods. And by the way, we've got a product that helps you manage that and reduces the likelihood that you would be tempted to use that because it's a temptation. When that buzzer goes off, don't you find who's that from or is it important or whatever it is? So, that's the type of thing that insurers can directly benefit from. And if they've got a policy in place that incentivizes a driver not to drink and drive, there's alternatives. They can take a ride-hail service for that matter. They can designate a driver. You don't use the phone. And by the way, distracted driving goes just beyond using the cell phone. Eh? There's other factors, eating and things like that. I was at a presentation with some OEMs who were there, and we were encouraging these guys or these OEMs who manufacture vehicles with all the technology that you can have hands-free, etc., MySync and a few other things. And the one person said to me, so if you're discouraging people from using their phone while they're driving, you're telling me that you're saying that they shouldn't use our technology. No, we're not saying that. There are times and places which they can use that. I think of an emergency, for example. Wouldn't it give you greater peace of mind to know that if in an emergency you could phone the police, phone armed response, phone the hospital, phone your spouse or something like that? So there are times and places, but this fact that people think that they've got the right to be permanently engaged on some type of communication device is blatantly dangerous.
Absolutely. Is it not counterintuitive, Eugene, that some manufacturers might be creating and innovating things that cause driver distraction? I think many drivers don't realize how much is actually within their control. But the other concerning thing that is impacting road safety is that road infrastructure is not really kept up with the number of drivers and users that are using the roads today. Derek, what is your experience of the quality of infrastructure like roads and how that affects driver behavior? And then perhaps maybe a little bit after that, you can tell us what you've seen on this in your work as a paramedic, as well as whether you've had to adapt your training in any way to cater for this. For example, how to dodge a pothole safely, if that sort of training even exists.
Look, the road infrastructure does play a part, and more so now than ever before. They're not maintaining roads, infrastructure, etc. So whilst you could train someone to be the best defensive driver out there, he can still have a collision. You know, you must remember defensive driving, if I send someone on a defensive driving course, train him, most companies think, well, that's fantastic, he's never going to crash. Then he crashes, and then they look at us and go, well, you trained him, why did he crash? So what we would have to look at, we have to look at the circumstances and the damage that's been caused in the crash. Maybe he put in defensive driving principles which limited the damage. If he didn't, maybe it would have resulted in a fatality, even worse. And like I said, you know, road infrastructure contributes to this. So for example, Eugene mentioned the potholes, you know, they're becoming permanent fixtures in South Africa. So that might lead us to swerve around a pothole and put us into another lane where there's an oncoming vehicle. So what do? Do we damage our car? And we always love our vehicles, you know. We don't want to damage that low-profile tire or that nice rim. So we'd rather steer into danger than hit the pothole. So defensive driving teaches you, you know, weigh up sort of collateral damage. But I'd rather maybe take out a rim and tire as opposed to, like I said, swerving into oncoming traffic and creating a major collision resulting in fatalities and injuries. So our training is focused around the safe system. And the safe system is, you know, used worldwide. And it says, look, you know, the three main components is the driver, the infrastructure, and what circumstances led to that. So whilst we're saying, yes, you swerve for the pothole and you hit the tree, like I said, you avoided hitting the truck. So that's what we look at in that whole safe system approach.
Lisa, if I can just add, what's not shown on Derek's bio is that he's a qualified accident investigator. We don't go and analyze blame. That's not the purpose of that. But if any, I think he alluded to it in his paramedics, he can have a look at it and say, if the person was applying defensive driving principles, would that accident crash have occurred? I need to use the word accident because sometimes people think that I'm talking about a separate subject. So let's accept that they crashed, but use the word accident. It enables us to provide information to our clients, and this is available to insurers as well. From our perspective, if there's anything that the driver could or should have done differently that would have prevented that crash. Now, We sit on accident review committees with companies, and we give them the benefit of our insight. This, of course, also contributes toward improved road safety because it's the corporates that are driving it. We're not seeing necessarily true leadership from government, but corporates can play an important role in changing the mindset of drivers.
Absolutely. And Old Mutual Insure, through their sponsorship of COTI, is all for road safety and the obvious benefits that has in terms of reduced premiums for our policyholders. Eugene, what do you think we need to have to happen to fix South Africa's poor road safety reputation? If you compare it to some global players, we don't rank too highly. We've already touched on some of the things from an infrastructure point of view, but what do you think over and above that you think we can improve? Is it something that's like deeply ingrained in us as South Africans to drive recklessly?
Okay. I think my best answer is to just lend some context to it, because whilst we say that we want to improve road safety, how committed are we as individuals? And the reason why I say that is when many people, particularly the new and upcoming generation, believe that when they get a license, it gives them the right to drive on the road. Now, in real terms, and we know that possibly 50% of licenses have been obtained in a fraudulent manner. So from an insurer's point of view, that must be a nightmare. Now, if they look at it as their right and not as a responsibility, they may then feel that they have the liberty to conduct themselves in various ways. Now, the old traditional way of looking at road safety was built on three E's: education, engineering, and enforcement. Just speaking to enforcement, who of us today have the confidence that that traffic officer, when he pulls us off for some reason or other, will not be asking for lunch money, a cool drink, or something such as that? And as a result of that, individuals on the road who believe that it's their right to drive feel that they can make mistakes. A mistake is one thing. But to disobey the law and then think that they can get away with it by bribing a policeman or a traffic officer or law enforcement speaks to the fact that we as drivers have to have a mindset change. Because if we fail, and please let's not get down the road where the government says, yes, but they wouldn't accept it if the driver didn't offer it to them. That's I think, obviating responsibility. No. You know the new system, administration and adjudication of traffic offences called ARTO? I heard an advocate from the RTI say, you know, that's not their problem when it comes to that. It's the traffic officials. Because if your license gets taken away, you know, in that new system, when it happens, you're without a job and all sorts of things like that. So I think in a short answer to your question is that we as South Africans have to accept that driving is a privilege and it is we carry with that responsibility. And if we see it like that, also knowing that that other person in that car coming toward us could well be a family member, a loved one, maybe it would change the way we think and do things. And if we do that, and the nice thing, and I must just commend Old Mutual for the initiative that they've taken in Road Safety Month, we as corporates have a responsibility to educate those who are less privileged than what we are. I think I need to share with you on one of the companies that we work with on a TV program gave away 300 courses. We donated. Now, you would have thought that they were oversubscribed. Less than 30% of people responded, and of that, about 10% said, can we exchange it for cash? Now, people, if they have no desire to improve their skills, well, that starts in schools. And I do think that some of the things that are missing there, and that's why one of the NPOs that I told you about, we are working with children to engender greater respect for road safety, for law enforcement, and all the good things that would make them responsible citizens down the road.
Yeah, that's a very interesting point, Eugene. I think what I'm realizing throughout this discussion is how important psychology and people's mental state is the difference between getting a driver's license being a right, or whether people in South Africans view it as a responsibility, cuts to, you know, the very high rates, accident rates or crash rates that we've seen in South Africa. And addressing some of those issues can lead to better road safety standards in South Africa, and also lower insurance premiums. If we all en masse change our behavior and change some of these misconceptions that we have around road use in general. One of the typical ones that we've seen, people relying on the safety systems, as you mentioned before, that they have, rather than thinking of it as something to rely on if you can't take any avoidable action or you can't avoid the situation happening, then those systems are supposed to be there, not for you to get into a situation where you have to, you're almost dependent on those systems to save your life. Yeah, so I'd say largely echoes with our experience at Old Mutual Insure. I'll also add that's a massive obstacle and barrier to improve road safety at the national level is that there's so many people that are uninsured and underinsured even, and driving around with unroadworthy vehicles in some cases. Of the estimated 11 million cars and drivers on the country's roads, only about one third, approximately 3.5 million cars, are insured. This means that if a driver is in an accident, the chances are high that it involves an uninsured driver. And unfortunately, there are more road incidents, which translates to higher premiums for policyholders. We do a lot of work around giving policyholders tips on what they can do to improve driving outcomes as well, one of which is around vehicle maintenance and roadworthiness. Derek, can you speak about the impact of vehicle maintenance and roadworthiness on road safety? It's certainly a huge factor in terms of insurance.
It is. And, you know, you mentioned a large percentage of our vehicles aren't roadworthy. And we all know that, you know, in some instances, you buy a secondhand vehicle, it's bought cash, it's not financed. You don't even have to take the vehicle to get a roadworthy certificate. You know someone that knows someone, and you get your roadworthy certificate. You know, so it goes back to Eugene saying that person will do that thinking it's the right thing to do. You know, so with regard to roadworthy vehicles, I mean, the major thing of collisions would be a tire failing. You know, so a lot of people, and I just love this, when they buy a car, they put a sound system, they upgrade the mags, and then what's the next thing when they need tires? They search around for a special, and they buy the cheapest tire and put it onto the vehicle. That's typically the only thing that's keeping you safe on the road. Those four things are what's keeping you safe. You know, do they check the pressure? No. Do they check for any damage on the sidewall, etc.? And I mean, at 120 kilometers an hour, you have a blowout on any one of those tires, you're not used to it, so you're going to react badly and cause a collision with other vehicles. You know, shocks again. I mean, I've seen vehicles driving down the road. You can see the shocks damaged. I don't know how the person doesn't feel it, but again, they just continue on their merry way and think, well, it's fine. You know, so two important things would be tires, shocks, and then general maintenance care of your vehicle. You know, it's, and again, going back to being a paramedic, I've been to many scenes where I get there and the vehicle's burnt out on the side of the road. And I'm thinking, that's got to do with maintenance. You know, vehicles don't just combust by themselves. It's got to do with something that progressively gets worse and worse and leads to a fire in the vehicle.
Can I just add something there? You know, the safe system that Derek has alluded to and I've spoken about, one of the components there is vehicles. So if a vehicle is inadequately prepared or it's not looked after, that's a contributory factor toward the accident. But it still doesn't mean, you know, and I'm sure that you've seen this, I've read it on insurance reports, well, the brakes failed. But that vehicle hasn't been near a service center in a million years. I know it's a gross exaggeration, but that's what it looks like. Or alternatively, the tire burst. But I've seen, and this is quite funny, people advertising secondhand mag wheels and tires. I've been driving it for the last 10,000 kilometers. There's a bump on the side of the tire, but it hasn't worried me. I look at that and I think, and I mean with great respect, how ignorant can you be? So a lot of it has to do with lack of knowledge. I think I may have shared previously, we did a survey through Road Safety Foundation a number of years ago, and at one of the toll plazas, people were asked if they knew what ABS was. In some instances, some smaller vehicles from manufacturers haven't had it. But by and large, they're all equipped with it. So now 70% of people didn't know what ABS was. So doesn't that place a responsibility on the person who's selling it? Yes, ignorance is no excuse, so the driver can learn. But how do you like this? Of the remaining 30% that said they knew with it, a good percentage said it didn't work. Now, typically in older cars, when you applied your foot to the brake, and you slammed your foot on the brake, you remember you had that pulsating feel. So what did they do? They left it off. So they said the brakes didn't work. The brakes worked perfectly. It is just that they were ignorant. So when you have a crash as a result of that, is it the car's fault? Clearly not. So I do think that lack of education contributes significantly toward that. And that's the role that we play. And if I can just tell you what we do, we produce a weekly newsletter. Goes out to this point, 17,000 people who read what we talk about. And there, it's always positive, eh? Always positive. And how it influences people. And we get thank you for sharing those things.
Awesome. Yes, Eugene, you raise a very important point there around people not necessarily knowing important information that they should around maintenance of their cars. And that might lead to buying decisions that they make, fitting those mags that were used for 10 years and probably not great to put on your next car. But let's say you are in that situation and unfortunately you have bought those mags and you fitted them onto your vehicle. Maybe a situation might arise where an accident or a crash is unavoidable. Let's maybe talk about what drivers should do. Derek, what steps do you think people should take in a roadside emergency?
Look, if they're involved in a collision and, you know, let's assume that there's no injuries involved, you know, that's a whole new thing. What people need to realize is the damage is done. So a lot of people get involved in a collision. The first thing they do is jump out the vehicle, rush off to see the damage, etc. You know, calm yourself down, get out the vehicle. We're in the age of technology. So again, for insurance purposes, footage is everything. You know, so firstly, I would encourage people to run dash cams in their vehicles. You know, video paints a very good picture for insurers. If not, take your phone, take a picture of the vehicle that you've collided with, the license disc, any damage. If you've got any witnesses, you know, I love to get to a collision scene. And the easiest way to get rid of bystanders is ask, Who would like to be a witness? Your scene is clear. There's no one there. But if you do have people around that are willing to help, you know, take the details down, take a picture of the driver's license that you can. So everything's recorded digitally because you're in a panic, you're stressing, and I mean, how many of us carry a pen and paper nowadays? So use your cell phone to your advantage. Collect that information, etc. And then again, look at your safety. You know, where has the collision occurred? Is it a safe place? Move away from the vehicle. Your safety is concerned. You know, I mean, going through the rainy season now, and we've had all these floods. Again, going to scenes where vehicles have been washed down the road. And unfortunately, people stay in their vehicle. I don't get it. You know, when you see water coming through the door, maybe that's a good time to get out. But people, I'm sure, you know, subconsciously think, well, I've paid a lot of money for this. I want to stay with it. And there they go off, washed down the river. And unfortunately, we have been to instances where we find people that have been, you know, fatal and they're in their vehicle from drowning. So the damage is done. Take care of your safety alone. You know, and again, if you can move vehicles, fine. Also remember, I mean, and the question for you is, do you know emergency numbers offhand without your cell phone? The answer is probably not. They're all stored in my cell phone. So who would I like to phone? You know, and some instances we get to collisions where the cell phone's destroyed. And we say to the person, would you like to phone a loved one? Because they want to speak to someone they know. And they look at me and go, I'd love to use your phone, but I don't know the number. So we encourage people to learn at least 3 emergency numbers that you know offhand. So if a bystander, you need to use their phone, you can obviously use it.
Can I just talk to one thing that I find absolutely fascinating? People have a crash. There's no injuries. What does the law say, Derek, with regard to, unless there's an injury, the cars can be moved off to the side of the road. But you see this long traffic queue because some person decides, no, I cannot move the car until the police have arrived. Now, just picking up on Derek's comment about witnesses, you know what, people at that moment, because very emotionally driven, they, yeah, use me as a witness. You try and get hold of them. Yeah, you can't. So, yes, yeah, a good idea. We've got recorders on our phone. Lisa, you've agreed. Would you mind being a witness? Do you mind if I just record what you said over there, please? We've got the facility and your contact details, etc. So we have it. And I'm sure that must be a blessing in disguise for the insurer where it's a third party's fault. So, guys, drivers, work with your insurer. Because they're there to work for you and help you. Don't see them as this necessary evil where I've got to pay money at the end of the month and I resent it. So some simple things, some of which Derek has shared with you. And I mean, he's spoken about, you get people there on the side of the road and then they stand. What happens if some guy's avoiding the traffic because he hasn't seen the traffic backed up and he swings out into the emergency lane and he comes and he collides with you standing in the back of it? Use some common sense, which we know is not too common, all right? But here's what you do. Don't think that you're going to remember those things, or have a process, a to-do list that's in the event of an accident. And this we can give as a gift to our children. This is best practice because that's the time. And I think research shows us that if in an emergency, you need to recall a number, it probably takes you three times as long to remember it. So that's not when the memory is great, eh?
No, absolutely. So a list like that would definitely do anyone good if they're in that situation. Those are some great tips for our listeners. Thank you. I encourage all of our policyholders to reference their policy wording, their policy schedules. Look at the emergency numbers that we've attached. Make notes of those emergency numbers. Maybe put them somewhere in the car if you are having a hard time remembering what the number is. That's always a great tip as well. Thank you, gentlemen. We also suggest that all of our policyholders have the Road Assistance app loaded onto their phones, as it provides drivers with access to 24/7 emergency assistance, including towing, flat tire service, and emergency fuel delivery. With the app, drivers can quickly get the help they need, no matter where they are. We also suggest to preload emergency contacts onto your phone before leaving for a trip, so that if anything untoward may happen, you have those numbers available. But the other aspect that we can't avoid talking about is our rate of vehicle hijackings and theft. This we've seen in certain manufacturers, or some manufacturers have been a little bit more affected by this than others. And it speaks to the car safety features that different manufacturers might employ in making sure that cars can't be hijacked. Eugene, can you offer some valuable advice or tips on this for listeners? What do they need to know about? What are the latest trends that we've seen around hijackings? We know that these criminals have been getting ever more creative with the ways that they employ to hijack vehicles.
I think that everybody will probably remember a session on Carte Blanche a few weeks ago where vehicles with remote fobs, you didn't need to hijack it. You just follow the guy and it picks up the signal and you can take it away. Let's remember why hijackings grew significantly in earlier years. It's because the technology introduced by manufacturers made it very difficult to steal. So the best bet was to be able to relieve the owner of the vehicle when the keys were in the ignition. And as a result, they then could drive away with it. And, you know, I must just share with you, we spent a lot of time researching on that. And vehicles that have been hijacked have almost within 24 hours been found across the border with correct paperwork, etc. So we must accept that syndicates are working these things. Now, trends do change. And if I can just give some kind of warnings about trends. We read an article that says, oh, this particular vehicle is hijacked more than others. In our hijack prevention training programs, personally, I share with five objectives, one of which should be that you should be happy to drive the vehicle of your choice. But it's like having a swimming pool. you know that children drown in a swimming pool, don't you? So there's increased risk. So you take greater prevention methods in order to ensure that you are less likely, notice the word less likely, to become a victim. And of course, whether or not that vehicle is particularly prone could also be governed by the numbers they sell. So statistically, it could have an impact on it. What does concern me when they say, oh, there's hijackings are very prevalent in a particular place. And it's true. But let's accept that those hijackers are not stupid. By the time you hear about where it was prevalent, they've moved to another place. So let's just finish that section off with giving some helpful tips that can work. There are main areas where your risk is greater than others. One in particular is when we're approaching our home. Now, you can picture at a psychological level, you approach your home, you start feeling safe, and already you're going through all the things that you're going to have to do, what to cook and the homework with the kids, etc. So mentally, you have removed yourself from the driving experience. That's the time when you should be most alert. So what we encourage that drivers, I just call it the last kilometer, make a conscious effort to be aware of what's going on around them. Now, that could mean if there are any vehicles following them. And remember, most hijackings are to order, so they may have been following you for a period of time to look at you. So if you notice a car that's unfamiliar, why do you do the same thing? You know, there's a strange car behind me, and as I pull up into the gate, and I typically pull front end into the gate, the hijacker parks behind you. Where can you go? So I think these habits that we've created over a period of time need to be readdressed. And the one thing that I ask any driver, your greatest area of risk is identify what it is. And if that means, and I'll share with you some of the arguments we get, that you stop outside the road while your gate is opening, so that if somebody did stop behind you, you can move off. You know what? That may be your neighbor who's new. But so what if you upset him? You haven't been hijacked, all right? You can always go and apologize to him or her afterwards. But you know what the answer I get? Yeah, but the traffic is heavy. What do you want? You know, I can't give you a perfect solution. I can give you an ideal solution. So that's the one area. And the other area is at intersections. You know, we travel through these intersections, and I'm quite sure you've seen the moment we come to a stop, what's the first thing people grab? Phone. So when they tell you, where do hijackers come from? Nowhere. That is so untrue. It's just that we didn't see them from where they came. And as a result, they caught us unaware. So at intersections, not that that's not the time that you should be, your attention should be drifting. True, in heavy traffic, it's less likely to occur. But during the evening hours when it's a little bit dark, maybe it could be that you're the first person at the intersection. And we teach in our training programs what you can do to even prevent that. But you've got to be prepared to accept that you must change the way you do things to minimize the likelihood of you becoming the next victim.
Exactly. Exactly. I must say, this has been a quite an enlightening discussion around habits that we form that might come back to bite us in certain situations. And being alert on the roads, always being alert, always making sure that you have the presence of mind to realize what's going on around you may just avoid you losing your car to hijackers and these criminal syndicates that are operating. But we know that over and above that, vehicle manufacturers have been working around the clock to prevent hijackings and vehicle theft from taking place. And technology is always advancing to offer policyholders that added level of comfort around making that buying decision when they think about buying a car, so that they don't necessarily always have to worry about getting hijacked. But you should do your part as well and have the presence of mind in all situations, all driving situations that you're in, to just know what's around you, know what's happening around you as well. Eugene and Derek, let's talk now about the role of technology and innovation in motoring and how it's preventing or assisting in some cases road safety. What are some of the latest things you're seeing, perhaps like in-car technology, such as lane assist when you're driving and so on?
Look, there has been a lot of improvement in vehicles, and you know, we have these sort of semi-autonomous vehicles. You know, they still require the driver to use them. If I can just talk to one thing where we've got adaptive cruise control, and you know, that is great and it does work phenomenally well. But it almost makes the driver lazy, you know, because now the other car moves in front of him and automatically the vehicle slows down, the car speeds up, the vehicle speeds up. You know, it's great to use that, but don't get too used to it. What happens if you're traveling for business and your only hire car is something without this technology? You know, does it make you worse or better? You know, so some of them do complement it, but absolutely use them, but don't rely on them fully. You know, still rely on your ability to get out of situations and monitor the situation. You know, lane departures, one of them as well, where it's great, but it's only as good as the infrastructure of the road. You know, we spoke about that earlier. If there's no lanes, what's the car look? What's the camera looking at? So these things also, they have their limitations as well.
Leo, just talking to the future, many people believe that autonomous vehicles will be the solution to road safety because then the vehicle will make all the decisions. There are a number of challenges associated with that. And that's, by the way, that's a subject for another discussion. But just think of the following. Derek mentioned, I think we're at autonomous level 3 or 4. Okay, somewhere along those lines. So it's not a giant leap forward to get to the next level. But in order for them to work in our country or in any country, you need minimum of 3 things. Stable power. Wow, Eskom, okay. You need an infrastructure that the LIDARs and radars can read. Oh, no lanes, so we appreciate the challenge. It could be on some roads that would work. And then the third component, it must have 5G compatibility because the amount of data that's got to be processed. So will it solve our problems, the African problem, South African problem? Not likely in the near future. But if I can just, and this deals not necessarily from a road safety perspective, but I'm sure it must be any insurer's nightmare. PDC, park distance control or cameras. I find I'm so spoiled by having that technology. I go and park a vehicle that doesn't have it. You know what I find? I'm like 3 meters away from the wall because we're just so conscious of it. Now, Derek mentioned we become used to these things. And as a result, we will do things on occasion that compromise the standards. And I have this horrible thought because we also road test vehicles, etc., and all the modern ones have them. So I get into an older vehicle and I reverse and I think, what will happen if I hit that? You know, and you don't have a crash today where you'd have any damage less than like 5K. So it's a source of concern to me. And if I can just talk to the future, we believe that some of the technology that's inherent in vehicles is great if we use it wisely. But we mustn't see that as the be-all and the end-all of road safety.
Absolutely, absolutely agree with that. Those systems are there to assist us, but we shouldn't completely rely on them. You as the driver still have ultimate responsibility. Derek, Eugene, in conclusion, maybe you can each please give us top 3 tips for drivers to take charge of their own safety on South African roads.
Look, I think the number one tip is just don't be on your cell phone. You know, that's the key tip. Stay off your cell phone. That way you're going to be more aware of your surroundings, etc. So you're preventing getting hijacked. You're preventing collisions. And the next tip is look after your investment, you know, your vehicle. We spoke about vehicle maintenance. Everyone sort of gets, you know, panicky when it comes to a first service. And then what do? They just miss the first service or the second service because of expense. So don't compromise on maintenance of the vehicle. We mentioned it before. I'll mention it again. Buy the best tires that you can afford and good name brand tires, you know, not the cheap ones. So good tires, definitely.
You know, I noticed Derek jumped in right at the outset and said he takes the easy ones. All right? So there's many more others. So don't think I'm crying wolf for right. The one thing that I would like motorists to think of, many of them look at the speed limit as a negative thing. Now, hold on. Some of them see that as the target speed, eh? So we don't look at that. And I'm talking speed limits in general. But we must remember that there's a certain science behind that. Speed limits are there to regulate traffic flow. Because if you have everybody driving at different speeds, and we can see what the difference is. And there must be some science to that. And true, you know, that there's if the average traffic is, or the traffic that we're moving in is doing, let's say, 130 kilometers an hour, and you insist on doing 120, you become a hazard to those other road users. So it's wise use of the prevailing speed limits. But if I can talk to the NPOs that we work with. And this is a worldwide initiative instituted by the World Health Organization from the United Nations to reduce speed limits in built-up areas. And I think the promotion is hashtag Love30 or something like that. The intention is that around areas where there are possible dangers, for example, schools, reduce the speed. Doesn't mean that because speed limit is 60 kilometers an hour, you do 60 kilometers in that area. That's the target speed. So where circumstances dictate, let's use common sense and slow down. Because if we slow down, there's more time for us to react if somebody runs in front of us. The likelihood of severe injury increases significantly as you go up to higher speeds. So I'm not saying to you, because you know what we do, we run high performance programs. So yes, we love speed, but we do it in a safe environment. If you want to do that, and by the way, it's open to listeners that they want to engage with us, they can do so with pleasure. But we advocate that you should be responsible about the use of speed, because remember, it's not speed that kills, it's a sudden stop.
Exactly. I often watch sometimes I watch the NCAP safety test that they do. And
do you know why it's done at that speed?
I don't.
Okay. I think it's 64 kilometers an hour or something like that. It's because if it was any faster, it would obliterate the vehicle. Now, 60, that's the speed we travel in built up areas. So can you imagine two cars at 120 coming from opposite direction with purely a white line in between? That's a closing speed of 240 kilometers an hour. Do you expect to survive that? Doesn't matter whether you've got airbags, whether you've got anything in it. It's not going to help.
Not at all. Just judging from the crash dummies and how they move and the whiplash, just based on that alone, I would drive below 60 kilometers an hour everywhere. But sometimes I forget those videos.
As long as you're not doing that on the highway, because then you're like that typical old lady that's never been involved in a crash, but she's caused 500 behind her.
Exactly. Cool. Thank you so much, gentlemen. Thank you for this enlightening chat. I've learned quite a lot. Hopefully our listeners and policyholders have learned quite a lot of things as well around what they can change. Little things and all the way up to really big things that you can change to improve your road safety outcomes on the road, and also we found out on the show also improve just your general mental health as well from these improved road safety habits. And that brings us to the end of today's episode. Derek and Eugene, thank you so much for joining me for the Old Mutual Insure Insurance Unpacked podcast. And to our listeners, I hope you've learned something new about road safety today. We hope you've enjoyed the conversation. Please remember that you can listen in on this podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and many other platforms. Don't forget to talk to us on our socials with the hashtag SACOTI2023. Until next time, stay on the road and stay safe.